Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Please be seated. In an abundance of caution, when the court left the bench a few minutes ago, I may or may not have submitted the Gibbs versus State matter. That's 55928. For the record, it is now submitted. And we will proceed with case 57299, Goodwin, Maduka, versus the 8th JD. The party in interest in this case is Romero, Shelley, and John. Counsel, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well.
Who cast for petitioners? Good afternoon, Justices and Counsel. May it please the Court. Under the clear principles set forth by this Court in 63 years of cases interpreting Rule 41E, Judge Bixler was required on the record before him to have granted petitioner's motion to dismiss. I would like to go through very briefly the timeline. I know that the justices are familiar with the record. But if you look at the timeline of this case, what you will see is that there were three trial settings, any one of which would have allowed the case to be tried within the five-year rule. And the first two of those settings were continued on a request by the plaintiff to continue the trial. The third was vacated on the court's own action, and the plaintiffs sat passively and did nothing and allowed that case to go by on the day that the five-year rule was to expire.
So what about the peremptory challenge?
The peremptory challenge is irrelevant, Your Honor.
Well, not to me it isn't.
Okay. And respectfully, the reason we believe it to be irrelevant is for a number of reasons.
Well, it was a good move on your part.
It was permissible under Rule 48.1, and therefore my client had the right to file the peremptory challenge. The cases are clear that even an action by the court, even if it makes it difficult for a party, even if it makes it literally impossible for a case to be tried, does not excuse a violation of the five rule. And importantly, when something of that nature occurs, where a trial date is vacated through no fault of counsel, there is an absolute burden on the respondent to have taken whatever steps were necessary to try and get the case reinstated. And in this case, the record is clear that there was no action taken whatsoever. The third point of law that we find in the 60-plus years of jurisprudence is that the courts will, in fact, attempt to accommodate the setting of a case, but counsel is required to take that burden and let the court know, we need to get this case started. And there's a series of cases where even a witness is called to get the trial started. So that's the reason, respectfully, Justice Cherry, that we believe that point to be non-dispositive. Now, in the 60-plus years of the court interpreting Rule 41E, we found what we characterize as nine bedrock principles of the rule that we believe set the rules of the road for the disposition of this issue today. Bedrock rule number one, dismissal is mandatory. Bedrock rule number two, the courts are not permitted to exercise discretion. Bedrock principle number three, the courts are not to balance the equities. Bedrock rule number four, and I have case citations in support of each of these. Plaintiffs cannot escape dismissal by blaming the court. Bedrock principle number five, plaintiffs cannot blame the defendant or claim waiver by conduct. This is a theme that runs throughout the cases, so much so that you look at a case like Trail v. Ferretta, in which in 1975, the parties had agreed to a trial date by stipulation that was after the five-year rule expired, and the court sua sponte dismissed that case. And the same rule comes through in the Prostock case, more recently in 1980, where the parties had stipulated to a trial date, trial continuance. And the court found that that was not relevant to the fact that the five-year rule had run and dismissed the case. Bedrock rule number six.
Well, before you go on to bedrock number six, I'd like to talk about bedrock number five.
Yes, sir.
How is it that the Prostack case permits an extension of 41E by oral stipulation when the rule itself, which I think is bedrock, requires a written stipulation?
That leaves...
Without much analysis, no citation to any authority, Prostek seems to substitute for the requirement for a written stipulation, an oral presentment by counsel presented in minutes of the court as a substitute. Now, the rule doesn't do that, and there's no analysis in the case itself that does that. Why shouldn't this court revisit Prostek?
Prostek didn't break new ground. Prostek simply acknowledged the rule of law that a stipulation by the parties in open court that is reduced to a minute entry has the effect of a written stipulation.
Well, actually, that's not the case. And except for a very few limited circumstances, dealing only with administrative procedures, is that acknowledged. That's not true in most every other instance. A minute order doesn't even count as an order in most of our jurisprudence. So why in this context, which has case-concluding effect, should we permit an oral stipulation in lieu of a written stipulation required by the rule?
Well, Your Honor, a couple of points there. One is, if the point is accurate that a minute entry does not suffice for purposes of a written stipulation for Rule 41E, then there was no agreement at all, and the five-year rule expired in April. So the case is disposed of on that ground. The other point I'd like to make with respect to your comment is you're referring, I believe, to Marcuse and the other cases that talk about what's the legal import of a minute entry. When does it have the force of law, and when is it simply a ministerial act that we can allow to govern something? Mm-hmm. And I'd like to make the distinction between a minute entry, which is purported to have an independent power of an order, and a minute entry, which is merely utilized as a writing for purposes of memorializing a stipulation of the parties. And I think that's an important distinction, especially when we get into the effect of the August minute entry in this case.
Well, go ahead and make your argument.
Well, sure.
I have a further question about
Yeah, I think this. The court is obviously interested in that since you asked for further briefing on that. And here is the petitioner's view of this. Petitioner's view of this is that the five-year rule was to expire in April of 2010. The parties reached a clear, unambiguous stipulation on the record in the February 2010 medical malpractice status check. It was unambiguous.
I can't help but intervening with that comment. Please. You think it's clear and ambiguous. Counsel does not. The point I'm making is that oral stipulations are fraught with problems because sometimes parties, either from a different perspective or memory, walk away with a different point of view about what was orally stipulated to. That is present in this case. Counsel thinks there was a complete waiver of the 41E. You think that it was a limited extension. Even the minute orders are suspect to me. No disrespect to the clerks who serve throughout the state, but they're not the best transcribers of what transpires in a court proceeding. A court reporter or recorder is. We have nothing here to address that. So my concern is the rule in Prostek something that this court should revisit? I know you're interested in the outcome. You say the five-year rule would run in any event, but I'm looking at it from the standpoint of the rule of law. And I don't think we would have the problem that we're dealing with in this case right now had there been a written stipulation.
I think the court is certainly correct on that point. And I guess the question is, if you have a five-year period which is going to expire in April, and the stipulation, the minute entry, which reflects a discussion between counsel, an agreement between counsel on the record, is insufficient to constitute an effective writing which constitutes a written stipulation for purposes of Rule 41E, then the effect of that is that the five-year rule expired without any extension.
Counsel, isn't it true that these dates, at least initially, were being set and certain stipulations or understandings being made a part of the record during what we fondly refer to as medical malpractice sweeps?
It was, Your Honor.
For which, in an ordinary courtroom, if you were to appear in front of the DJ and some discussion was had in a pretrial conference, there would, of course, be a transcript of what everyone said, and even notwithstanding the minute order, the judge might say, counsel, you know, would you reduce our agreement here or to writing? In and of itself, the medical malpractice sweeps where this all seems to have begun its slide to where we are here today are very different than any other ordinary proceeding. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with you that the court convening and having dozens of or scores of lawyers to talk about probably hundreds of cases over the course of a two and a half, three-day period is certainly different from
that. And isn't it also true that when we're trying to set these type of cases, whether they be medical malpractice or constructional defect, that oftentimes the problem with setting them is that there's no available courtroom, and so in fact the judges essentially throw up their hands and say, counsel, if we're going to get this set, you're going to have to waive the five-year rule. Do we all agree we're going to waive the five-year rule? Is that common practice, at least in the 8th Judicial District?
That conversation frequently takes place.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it does.
And so that sort of emphasizes why writing is required because of the rather informal nature. Would you agree with me?
I would agree that a writing would probably have made today's proceedings either non-existent or very different. And I think the question becomes, what is the effect of a less than adequate stipulation in terms of a violation of the five-year rule?
A case concluded.
Well, let's assuming for the moment that Prostek is not revisited by the court and oral stipulations are permissible. What is to prevent the judge from interpreting the minutes? What precludes him from interpreting the minutes differently than you did?
The reason the August minute entry is not part of the analysis in our view is that the oral stipulation was clear that the case five-year rule would be extended until a date certain. And so, therefore, when that date arrived and the trial did not begin and there had been no efforts by counsel to do anything to get it, to get another judge, to get another department, to get the case tried, no alert to the judiciary, we need to try this case on July 12th, that at that point, under the Cox case, which is the most recent pronouncement on this issue in which the court acknowledged that it was setting forth a rule of law, that it's subject matter jurisdictional, then the case was over on July 12th of 2010 with the trial not having started. And therefore, anything that occurred at a subsequent sweeps with hundreds of cases and scores of lawyers setting down a trial date is irrelevant. And the minute entry from August doesn't reflect a stipulation of counsel. The stipulation that was reached was in February. We need to get this case tried by April. What do you have open on your calendar? We can do July 12th. We'll stipulate to extend the five-year rule until July 12th. That's what the minutes reflect. And this is where we get back to the 60-plus years of cases, talking about the strict nature of the rule, the burden on counsel to move the case forward. And that's where we get back to looking at the prior history of the case, too, during the other 4 years plus in which we had trial dates, where petitioners were ready for trial on all occasions, and the case was continued at the request of the respondents.
So how many trial dates were there before February?
There was two before February, the most recent in August of 2009, at which we appeared at calendar call ready.
But technically, in August, the case was, by your reasoning...
Oh, I'm sorry. By August 2009, by February of 2010...
That was my question.
Yes,
before
there was two
February
prior...
February 2010.
Two settings. And the third was the setting we got at the February 2010 sweeps, which resulted in the July trial date.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever any consideration given to the practice that has been recognized in French Bouquet and some other of these cases where you convene the trial, call one witness, and it's, I think I've indicated in other cases, I don't approve of that practice, but it's been one that's been recognized. Was that ever considered here?
Petitioners took no steps, zero, not a single step to advance the case to trial after the July 12th, 2010 trial date was vacated.
You mean the plaintiff?
The respondents, excuse me. Thank you. And therefore, whether they had filed a motion on an OST, written a letter to me, to the court, done something, then we don't know whether somebody would have accommodated a short trial, something to trigger it. Presumably, we would have gotten a senior judge or another judge and had our jury trial. And so that's why we get back to the rule of law on these cases for these years. And we examined the proceedings of the trial leading up to the situation we were in the February of 2010 sweeps.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you at bedrock five. Were you compelled to go on to number six?
I can provide the last four quite briefly, Judge.
Let me counsel you that if you do so, you have now exceeded your entire time on argument.
I will wait for rebuttal then.
You've actually expired your rebuttal time at this point. You went through your five-minute warning, but let's see how we go on the other side of the argument.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Kurt Harris on behalf of John Romero and Shelley Romero, and they're present here with me today. May it please the court. I guess I wish to address some of the questions that have gone on, if I could, really, very quickly. I don't think that revisiting Prostat case is the best idea, given the fact that in looking at that and hearing Your Honor speak of that, Justice, a lot of times these stipulations are done during trial, and they're kind of done on the run. And had I required a written stipulation at the time of the sweeps, somebody would have had to sit down and written that. And if that had been the case, in practice, I wouldn't have left the room without something in writing. And while I do believe that probably is the most prudent thing, we wouldn't be here today if that were the case. It would certainly slow down a lot of the trial procedures that go on as attorneys do enter into stipulations on the record in front of the judges. And I believe that's where the Prostat case, someone says, this happens. This is the kind of thing that happens kind of on the fly occasionally. And counsel do enter agreements. They're in the minutes, and we honor those agreements. We have no further to look in this matter. As it's been stated here that we sat silently and did nothing. And I do want to address that a little bit. It isn't that I didn't do anything. In December 21st, 2009, I filed a motion to set trial. I received an opposition to that trial from the petitioner's counsel indicating, you can't do this. Okay, and I quote from his brief, which was submitted January 11th of 2010, through the present motion, plaintiffs, that's me, are requesting this court circumvent the process by which all medical malpractice cases in Clark County are set for trial. Specifically, medical malpractice cases are required to go through sweeps before a panel of judges every February and August, during which the status of the case is addressed and a trial date assigned, based on the consideration of multiple factors, including the availability of the parties. This is the exclusive means by which medical malpractice cases are set for trial. That's the petitioners saying that. The only way to set a case for trial is to go through the sweeps. It's the exclusive means. It's the only thing that Judge Bixler agreed with him at the motion to dismiss hearing, where he indicated, absolutely, you don't just reset these trials. You just don't get to do that. It has to go through the sweeps, and we have to find availability in courtrooms.
How did the court rule on your motion?
Judge Bixler denied the motion to dismiss.
In February, at the time of the February hearing.
At the time of the, it was October. October 20th, 2010 was when that hearing took place on the motion to dismiss.
On a motion you filed in December of 2009?
Oh, on my motion.
Motion to set the trial.
I'm sorry, I got confused. He denied my motion and said it wasn't Judge Bixler at that time. I can't remember which. It's bounced from a multitude of departments. My motion was denied and said you need to go to sweeps. And there is an order that indicates that I had to go back to sweep, which I did. I couldn't get a trial setting at that time. So with that in mind, carrying forward in this case, when I saw the peremptory go...
You were given a trial date in July.
Yes, July 12th.
That didn't occur through sweeps, did it?
Yes, it did. That was set at the prior sweep. And that was set on the February 2nd, 2010 sweeps. And at that time, we were accommodating petitioner's counsel's his calendar. We said, I'm not available. I can't try the case. I'll stipulate to waive the five-year rule if you'll extend. I was ready to go to trial prior to the April 25th when the five-year statute was going to expire, and he indicated he couldn't try the case. I gave him professional courtesy. The case was extended. It wasn't mentioned at the time of those sweeps that it was a limited waiver or anything of the like. At that time, he mentioned that he would extend it through the trial.
Why insert July into the stipulation?
The July 12th.
If it wasn't a limited extension, why
I guess that was the minutes. It showed up in the minutes as that being the date of trial. And there certainly wasn't a record kept there.
Well, the way we did sweeps is the clerks would keep a whole list, and they would just put a date down, and we didn't even know what the date was when we did CD sweeps. This is the jurist who invented the sweeps, sitting right next to me.
Yes.
He invented it, and I went along with her, and so did Judge Earl, and then it was such a great success for construction defect, they decided to do it for Amend Mouse.
And it's my belief she the Honorable Justice, is quite familiar with them, and it they do move rather quickly. And it was just a matter of there was no statement that I would put out a limited waiver. It was always the 5-year rule until the date of trial. And without me being able to, me trying to extend professional courtesy, I said, okay, that'd be fine. We got our trial date for July. And then we moved from department to department to department with absolutely no control that I had at that point.
Well, I don't blame Mr. Katz for filing a peremptory. He had an absolute right to do that. He was not satisfied that an important case representing a medical professional that he felt that he needed a different department. So,
and I 100% do not disagree that he has a right. He has a right to do that. And we don't say that there's a right, but our position is that at that point, when you do exercise your rights, there are certain burdens that have to go with those rights. And it's our position that's a waiver. It's an
But why didn't the two of you go to the judge, to one any of the judges, or to the chief judge, and say, we need to do something about this 5-year rule? When Justice Sade and I became district judges in 1999, we had a lot of situations with this 5-rule situation, because these assignments, I know they drive you guys crazy. And then maybe, this is a case where, again, and the thing I hate to see is when a judge does something that would affect either a petitioner or a respondent in an appeal. And
honestly,
I just think that judges should have done something about this, not you fellas. I think both of you were doing what you were supposed to do, but I wish you had done a little more, but you didn't.
And honestly, Justice, I thought that, but bearing in the back of my mind this exclusive method of setting trial dates, having filed a motion to set trial once in the past and being turned away, in the back of my mind I'm thinking, well, I have to wait for a reassignment. I have to go back to the Med-Mouse sweeps, which is essentially what I did. I didn't criticize them for filing what they have a right to file, merely that I figured that it needed to go back to the sweeps at that time, having been down that road once before of trying to prod the case and of trying to get it set for trial and being turned away. When they do file that peremptory, though, it acts as an implied waiver of, if it were in fact a limited waiver of the 5-year rule, which we disagree with, it impliedly waives that waiver at that point and extends it out because it made the case impossible to try, given the fact that it wasn't assigned to a department. It left Judge Walsh's department and was reassigned to Judge Smith's. I know my secretary contacted Judge Smith and they said, you're not on calendar. And it was wait for the Med-Mal sweeps. That really was it. Honestly, and I do agree, I did not write a letter to the chief judge. I didn't call the chief judge. At that point, I waited for the Med-Mal sweeps, which we did show up at on August 3rd, 2010. And at that point, Mr. Cass appears again and doesn't raise any objection whatsoever, provides dates for trial, and trial is reset. And this is weeks after he's filed his peremptory. He doesn't indicate, hey, that was a limited waiver and it's over. We set trial again for April. And it isn't until 5 weeks after that sweep that they file this motion to dismiss. And that's why Judge Bixler looked at it and said, it would be a travesty of justice for me to grant this motion to dismiss. Judge Bixler was there both times at the sweeps. Judge Bixler was the chief judge at the sweeps that I informed I was having a 5-year rule issue. Judge Bixler witnessed all that and was present at both those sweeps as well as the motion to dismiss. He knew the case. He was very well informed. He knew what was happening, and he was very confident at the time that he rendered his ruling. He did not abuse his discretion. As far as the 63 years of case law that stands behind this rule, there is an exception carved out in the rule, except where there's a stipulation. And it's our position that there is, in fact, a stipulation. It doesn't reverse 63 years. It just says there's a stipulation in this case. It's an exception to those rules. And there aren't any cases that I could find on point where there's been a breach of that stipulation or a case didn't happen after there was a waiver and the trial date didn't occur. But it's our position that it was through no fault of our own that the trial did not happen. We did not cause it. We do not hold ill will that they exercised a right of peremptory. It's just that the effects of that indicated that the case was virtually impossible to go to trial, if not impossible. We had to go back to the sweeps, which we did in August 3rd. And at that time, there was no objection. And that was a month after the trial should have begun. There was no objection at that time. And so it's our further position that it's a second waiver. If you set trial and you provide dates and you say, I'm here and I'm prepared to try the case on this date in April, then you've impliedly wavered one more time. You've waived your right to raise this issue that the five-year rule is run.
So technically at the August sweeps, if we adopt the petitioner's rationale, the case no longer existed for purposes of sweeps at all.
Correct. And he should have said, this case should be dismissed, and I'm not going to set trial. I'm filing a motion to dismiss, which should have been done weeks before that anyway.
In fact, which frequently happened. Oftentimes when we call cases on sweeps, the parties approach and they simply say, this case has been settled, you can take it off calendar. I presume then that a similar comment could have been made by counsel. This case is subject to 41E. It no longer exists. It's not appropriate to be set for trial.
And again, that was my assumption, Your Honor, as I walked out of the
courtroom. Is Mr. Cass obligated to say that at the sweeps?
I believe you are obligated.
What rule or case supports that contention? He shows up at the sweeps. These sweeps are not substantive in nature. They're simply assigning trial dates. What rule or case requires him to say, this should be dismissed under 41E? I would imagine the judges conducting the sweeps would say, file a motion.
And I absolutely...
Why should there be any consequence to a lawyer or a party who doesn't inform the court that the case may have already been expired under 41E?
And in fairness, I sort of made that argument. I don't want to... My argument
And I can't really cite a rule for you, Justice Hardesty. I can only say that as a matter of professionalism and that it was misleading to the court to come there that day and provide dates to the clerks to have a trial set, to have the case reassigned to Judge Bixler, to have us go through all those gyrations only to file a motion to dismiss 5 weeks later.
Well...
And I believe it's a matter
candor
of...
candor to the court, matter of professionalism.
Professional ethics.
Those rules are all issues that are interesting to raise. Here we're trying to decide what the rule and the law is governing this case and whether 41E barred it from any further prosecution.
And it's our position that it didn't. Once there is this waiver out there, and once the five-year rule is extended, that indeed it's open. They wanted to come back later and say that it was a limited waiver. I did not get that impression when I was there at the sweeps. Judge Bixler did not get that impression either, but that's what the minutes say. Subsequent to that, there's essentially another waiver because the peremptory makes it impossible to go to trial at that time. The third time, we come in at the third sweeps, and there's no objection raised whatsoever. Another trial date is set.
I'm not sure about the practice in the 8th District, Mr. Harris, but following these sweeps, are counsel provided with copies of these minutes, or are they simply retained in the court?
They're retained in the court. You're not necessarily provided with minutes. You can get them online.
Right, but I mean they're not served on you, are they?
No, but subsequently a trial order will be served indicating your trial date, your department.
Well, but the trial order in this case, setting the trial for July, did it contain any reference to the stipulation that was contained in the minutes?
No, it did not.
So when you left the sweeps in February, your impression was that the five-year rule had been waived until we next try the case.
Correct.
And Mr. Cass's view is that we left, when he left, that we've waived the five-year rule until the date certain for trial. And the minutes, which under Prostack are supposed to be the embodiment of the substitution for a written stipulation, weren't served on anybody.
That's correct.
Okay.
Well, could it have been more interesting if you had filed a motion to strike the peremptory? I mean, that would have been another issue. This is just like a can of worms as far as I'm concerned.
That's something I probably should have done.
It's a rarity when this justice feels bad for both sides.
This is a tough call.
Thank you. We We do want to thank you for your time. We do believe that we are quite firm in our position here, and that this is a matter that, as far as Judge Bixler goes, that he did not abuse his discretion. He was present at both of those sweeps. He was there at the motion to dismiss. He does know that there is a process and procedure for setting these cases in Clark County, and that they have to be done pursuant to sweeps, and that is...
You refer to Judge Bixler's abuse of discretion, but isn't this an issue that is subject to de novo review? Whether the 41E extension occurred or not is a matter of law, is it not?
It is. And I was looking at it more of his inherent authority.
I appreciate your point, but I just want to make sure that we're clear on the standard of review here. It's really a de novo review, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Okay.
With that being said, we respectfully request that this writ be denied and that my client be allowed to have her day in court so that she can seek her trial. She's waited a long time, and we respectfully request that the writ be denied. Thank you very much.
Counsel, in light of this important issue, I'll give you 1 minute on rebuttal.
Thank you, Justice Sato. The statement counsel made regarding the February sweeps is not supported by the record. The minute entry, either there's no stipulation and there's no agreement, in which case the five-year rule expired on its natural clock in April, or there was an agreement, in which case the minute entry is clear, unambiguous, and explicit as to what the exact terms of that stipulation were, and the five-year rule expired in July. The second thing is, counsel made the statement that's not supported by Nevada law, that when we filed our peremptory challenge, it came with a burden. We did not have the burden of doing anything, and this brings me to my bedrock principles number 5, which is plaintiffs can't blame defendant or claim waiver, and plaintiffs and only plaintiffs have the burden of pushing a case to trial. That's the rule of the law in the state. They had to do something, and they did nothing. And therefore, the court was without jurisdiction after July 12th to take any further action on the case.
Thank you, Mr. Katz.
Thank you, Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. This matter will stand submitted. The court will be in recess until 3:30.